This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Man Alive by G.K. Chesterton. Section 3, Part 1, The Enigmas of Innocent Smith. Chapter 2, The Luggage of an Optimist. Part 1. We all remember the fairy tales of science in our infancy, which played with the supposition that large animals could jump in proportion of small ones. If an elephant were as strong as a grasshopper, he could, I suppose, spring clean out of the zoological gardens and alight trumpeting upon Primrose Hill. If a whale could leap from the sea like a trout, perhaps men might look up and see one soaring above Yarmouth like the winged island of Laputa. Such natural energy, though sublime, might certainly be inconvenient, and much of this inconvenience attended the gaiety and good intentions of the man in green. Because he was lively as well as large, by a fortunate physical provision, most very substantial creatures are also reposeful, and middle-class boarding-houses in the lesser parts of London are not built for a man as big as a bull and as excitable as a kitten. When Inglewood followed the stranger into the boarding-house, he found him talking earnestly, and in his own opinion privately, to the helpless Mrs. Duke. That fat, faint lady could only goggle up like a dying fish at the enormous new gentleman who politely offered himself as a lodger. With vast gestures of the wide white hat in one hand and the yellow Gladstone bag in the other. Fortunately, Mrs. Duke's more efficient niece and partner was there to complete the contrast, for, indeed, all the people of the house had somehow collected in the room. This fact, in truth, was typical of the whole episode. The visitor created an atmosphere of comic crisis, and from the time he came into the house to the time he left it, he somehow got the company to gather and even follow, though in derision, as children gather and follow a Punch and Judy. An hour ago, and for 4 years previously, these people had avoided each other even when they had really liked each other. They had slid in and out of dismal and deserted rooms in search of particular newspapers or private needlework. Even now they all came casually, as with varying interests, but they all came. There was the embarrassed Inglewood, still a sort of red shadow. There was the unembarrassed Warner, a pallid but solid substance. There was Michael Moon, offering, like a riddle, the contrast of the horsey crudeness of his clothes and the somber sagacity of his visage. He was now joined by his yet more comic crony, Moses Gould. Swaggering on short legs with prosperous purple tie, he was the gayest of godless little dogs, but like a dog also in this, that however he danced and wagged with delight, the two dark eyes on each side of his protuberant nose glistened gloomily like black buttons. There was Miss Rosamond Hunt, still with the fine white hat framing her square good-looking face, and still with her native air of being dressed for some party that never came off. She, also, like Mr. Moon, had a new companion, new so far as this narrative goes, but in reality an old friend and a protégé. This was a slight young woman in dark grey, and in no way notable but for a load of dull red hair, of which the shape somehow gave her pale face that triangular, almost peaked appearance which was given by the lowering headdress and deep, rich ruff of the Elizabethan beauties. Her surname seemed to be Grey, and Miss Hunt called her Mary, in that indescribable tone applied to a dependent who has practically become a friend. She wore a small silver cross on her very businesslike grey clothes, and was the only member of the party who went to church. Last, but the reverse of least, there was Diana Duke, studying the newcomer with eyes of steel and listening carefully to every idiotic word he said. As for Mrs. Duke, she smiled up at him, but never dreamed of listening to him. She had never really listened to anyone in her life, which some said was why she had survived. Nevertheless, Mrs. Duke was pleased with her new guest's concentration of courtesy upon herself, for no one ever spoke seriously to her any more than she listened seriously to any one. And she almost beamed as the stranger, with yet wider and far almost whirling gestures of explanation, with his huge hat and bag, apologized for having entered by the wall instead of the front door. He was understood to put it down to an unfortunate family tradition of neatness and care of his clothes. "My mother was rather strict about it, to tell the truth," he said, lowering his voice to Mrs. Duke. "She never liked me to lose my cap at school. And when a man's been taught to be tidy and neat, it sticks to him." Mrs. Duke weakly gasped that she was sure he must have had a good mother, but her niece seemed inclined to probe the matter further. "You've got a funny idea of neatness," she said, "if it's of jumping garden walls and clambering up garden trees. A man can't very well climb a tree tidily." "He can clear a wall neatly," said Michael Moon. "I saw him do it." Smith seemed to be regarding the girl with genuine astonishment. "My dear young lady," he said, "I was tidying the tree. You don't want last year's hats there, do you? Any more than last year's leaves? The wind takes off the leaves, but it couldn't manage the hat. That wind, I suppose, has tidied the whole forest today. Rum idea, this is, that tidiness is a timid, quiet sort of thing. Why, tidiness is a toil for giants. You can't tidy up anything without untidying yourself. Just look at my trousers. Don't you know that? Haven't you ever had a spring cleaning?" "Oh, yes, sir," said Mrs. Duke, almost eagerly. "You'll find everything of that sort quite nice." For the first time, she had heard two words that she could understand. Miss Diana Duke seemed to be studying the stranger with a sort of spasm of calculation. Then her black eyes snapped with decision, and she said that he could have a particular bedroom on the top floor if he liked, and the silent and sensitive Inglewood, who had been on the rack through these cross purposes, eagerly offered to show him up to the room. Smith went up to the stairs four at a time, and when he bumped his head against the ultimate ceiling, Inglewood had an odd sensation that the tall house was much shorter than it used to be. Arthur Inglewood followed his old friend, or his new friend, for he did not very clearly know which he was. The face looked very like his old schoolfellow at one second, and very unlike at another. And when Inglewood broke through the native politeness so far as to say suddenly, "Is your name Smith?" he received only the unenlightening reply, "Quite right, quite right, very good, excellent," which appeared to Inglewood, on reflection, rather the speech of a newborn babe accepting a name than of a grown-up man admitting one. Despite these doubts about identity, the hapless Inglewood watched the other unpack, and soon about his bedroom, in all the important attitudes of the male friend, Mr. Smith unpacked with the same kind of whirling accuracy with which he climbed a tree, throwing things out of his bag as if they were rubbish, yet managing to distribute quite a regular pattern all round him on the floor. As he did so, he continued to talk in the same somewhat gasping manner. He had come upstairs four steps at a time, but even without this, his style of speech was breathless and fragmentary, and his remarks were still a string of more or less significant, but often separate pictures. "Like the Day of Judgment," he said, throwing a bottle so that it somehow settled rocking on its right end. "People say vast universe, infinity, and astronomy. Not sure. I think things are too close together. Packed up for traveling. Stars too close, really. Why, the sun's a star, too close to be seen properly. The earth's a star, too close to be seen at all. Too many pebbles on the beach. Ought all to be put in rings. Too many blades of grass to study. Feathers on a bird make the brain reel. Wait till the big bag is unpacked. May all be put in our right places then." Here he stopped literally for breath, throwing a shirt to the other end of the room and then a bottle of ink so that it fell quite neatly beyond it. Inglewood looked round on this strange, half-symmetrical disorder with increasing doubt. In fact, the more one explored Mr. Smith's holiday luggage, the less one could make anything of it. One peculiarity of it was that almost everything seemed to be there for the wrong reason. What is secondary with everyone else was primary with him, He would wrap up a pot or a pan in brown paper, and the unthinking assistant would discover that the pot was valueless or even unnecessary, and that it was the brown paper that was truly precious. He produced two or three boxes of cigars and explained with plain and perplexing sincerity that he was no smoker, but that cigar box wood was by far the best for fretwork. He also exhibited about six small bottles of wine, white and red, and Inglewood, happening to note a Volnay which he knew to be excellent, supposed at first that the stranger was an epicure in vintages. He was therefore surprised to find that the next bottle was a vile sham claret from the colonies, which even colonials, to do them justice, do not drink. It was only then that he observed that all six bottles had those bright metallic seals of various tints, and seemed to have been chosen solely because they have the three primary and three secondary colors, red, blue, and yellow, green, violet, and orange. There grew upon Inglewood an almost creepy sense of the real childishness of this creature, for Smith was really, so far as human psychology can be, innocent. He had the sensualities of innocent. He loved the stickiness of gum, and he cut white wood greedily as if he were cutting a cake. To this man, wine was not a doubtful thing to be defended or denounced. It was a quaintly colored syrup, such as a child sees in a shop window. He talked dominantly and rushed the social situation, but he was not asserting himself like a Superman in a modern play. He was simply forgetting himself like a little boy at a party. He had somehow made the giant stride from babyhood to manhood, and missed that crisis in youth when most of us grow old. As he shunted his big bag, Arthur observed the initials I.S. printed on one side of it, and remembered that Smith had been called Innocent Smith at school. Though whether as a formal Christian name or a moral description, he could not remember. He was just about to venture another question when there was a knock at the door, and the short figure of Mr. Gould offered itself, with the melancholy moon standing like his tall, crooked shadow behind him. They had drifted up the stairs after the other two men with the wandering gregariousness of the male. "Hope there's no intrusion," said the beaming Moses, with a glow of good nature, but not the airiest tinge of apology. "The truth is," said Michael Moon, with a comparative courtesy, "we thought we might see if they had made you comfortable. Miss Duke is rather—" "I know," cried the stranger, looking up radiantly from his bag. "Magnificent, isn't she? Go close to her, hear military music going by like Joan of Arc." Inglewood stared and stared at the speaker like one who has just heard a wild fairy tale, which nevertheless contains one small and forgotten fact. For he remembered how he himself had thought of Joan of Arc years ago, when hardly more than a schoolboy he had first come to the boarding house. Long since the pulverizing rationalism of his friend Dr. Warner had crushed such youthful ignorances and disproportionate dreams, under the Warnerian skepticism and science of hopeless human types, Inglewood had long come to regard himself as a timid, insufficient, and weak type who would never marry, to regard Diana Duke as a materialistic maidservant, and to regard his first fancy for her as the small, dull farce of a collegian kissing his landlady's daughter. And yet the phrase about military music moved him queerly, as if he had heard those distant drums. End of part 1.